Welcome to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. And along with my brother Rick, we examine current events in the light of God's prophetic word. Folks, this last weekend we had a great time up in Farmington, Maine at Farmington Baptist Church. Had such a great time of sharing and teaching God's prophetic word for us today as we live. And I am more and more convinced that we need to be pure, productive, and prepared to live a holy life in an unholy world. You know, 1 Peter 3:15 says, and I use this verse a lot when I teach in Bible conferences, but in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but to do this with gentleness and respect. It's a verse that motivates Christian apologists as they prepare to give answers in defense of their faith. We have a program today that I think is very important, talking to Ken Timmerman, David Dolan, Winky Medad, Bill Federer, who was a very close friend, personal friend, with Charlie Kirk. And on today's program, we're going to talk about the reason as to why that we need to be able to give a defense for what we believe and to do it with gentleness and respect. Always remember that this is a perfect time in history to live a Christian life. And Paul told Timothy that if you're living a godly life, you will suffer persecution. Well, Rick, we've got a lot to cover today, so we need to get started with our first, Ken Timmerman.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. I have Ken Timmerman. He's our expert on geopolitical affairs. He's an author and an analyst. Ken, thanks for being with us today.
Rick, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Ken, a lot of things happened this week. I'm going to get your thoughts on many different things, but let's start with the situation in Europe. Russia drones into Poland. Many people are saying that this is something that could trigger NATO defense. Can you give us a report on the situation there?
Well, on Wednesday, the Russian sent drones into Poland, 19 to be exact. It seems to have been a deliberate penetration of NATO airspace, not just an accident. They came in from Belarus. It seems that Putin is testing the gray zone of NATO's defenses. The Poles invoked Article 4 of the North Atlantic Treaty. This is not the mutual defense clause of Article 5. The intention is to assess the actual meaning of Russia's actions. Was it an attack on NATO or was it a probe on NATO? And how should NATO respond? So they had that meeting, if you wish, these consultations on Wednesday. The Article 4 has only been invoked, Rick, 7 times since 1949. So this is very unusual. Recently, it was invoked by Poland and the Baltic states when Russia invaded Ukraine in February 22. Poland also invoked it in 2014 when Russia annexed the Crimea in Ukraine. And before that, it was only invoked by Turkey, basically over terrorist operations in Iraq and in Syria. So this is a very rare thing that has happened. President Trump at first expressed surprise that the Russians had launched these drones into Poland. Then later on, he said, well, maybe it was a mistake. But regardless, this is a quote, I'm not happy about anything having to do with that whole situation, but hopefully it's going to come to an end. Look, I think, Rick, this is serious. Putin is testing us. He's going into the gray zone. NATO also showed it was not very effective in its response. The Poles scrambled F-35 jets, F-16 jets to go after these $40,000 drones. They only hit 3 of the 19, by the way. The Ukrainians are hitting 80% of them. So we have a real problem. If we have to use multi-million dollar systems to go after these $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 drones, we've got to up our game as far as defense goes.
Well, Ken, this was a huge story in the middle of the week before, unfortunately, later events took over the news cycle. But we know that small sparks can start a big fire. Is this something we need to be concerned about? Could this spark a larger conflict there in Europe?
Yes, it could, Rick. And I think that's why Putin is testing us. He wants to see our response. He wants to see how we're going to respond to this type of challenge. And if we don't respond, my guess is he's going to do it again, maybe with larger forces. Perhaps he may even attack a NATO air base in eastern Poland, because they have air bases close to Russia. So I think it is very serious. We do need to pay attention to it. And, you know, it requires a NATO response.
Well, President Trump's toolbox to deal with a situation like this and to deal with Russia hopefully does not include a military response, because that's not necessarily something we want, but maybe an economic response. And I believe he's getting ready to do something like that, isn't he?
He is. He's talked about new tariffs. He's trying to get the Europeans to do what we have done, which is to put 50% tariffs on Russia's clients, India and China very specifically. But the Europeans aren't really very eager to go in that direction. They have said quite publicly that tariffs go against their, quote, core principles. This is Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission. She said tariffs are taxes on domestic consumers, and they prefer to do sanctions. Well, they've had sanctions. They've had sanctions since the beginning of the war. The sanctions on Russia have done nothing. That's why Trump is using a different economic tool. I think this is going to be a big, let's say, discussion between the U.S. and the Europeans. And at this point, I'm not sure who's going to win out, whether Trump's strategy of tariffs or whether the European strategy of sanctions.
Well, we'll continue to follow that situation as we have been for quite some time now. But let's move to the Middle East. And last week you reported on the Muslim Brotherhood based on a resolution that Senator Ted Cruz is putting out. And I'd like to continue that conversation as we look at their growing influence in the Middle East, especially when it comes to the nation of Sudan there, where they have a grip on the army that threatens regional stability and global trade. Can you talk about that?
Well, they do, Rick. And if you think Yemen is bad with the Islamist Houthis supported by Iran, just wait for a complete Muslim Brotherhood takeover of Sudan, also supported by the Iranian regime. That would, again, threaten Red Sea oil supplies along basically the entire Red Sea, not just at that choke point at the Bab al-Mandab in Yemen. It would probably lead to an inflation of global oil prices and would revive Sudan as a terror hub. And remember, Sudan is a country that signed on to the Abraham Accords. You wonder where that is at this point. So this is a very serious development. You have the head of the Sudanese Armed Forces, General Burhan, who recently made the gesture of firing five of his Islamist generals. But a lot of observers are not sure that that was a real step in the right direction. They thought it was subterfuge, and the Sudanese armed forces were fighting with another faction, right, that is anti-Islamist. They have increasingly been relying on the Iranian regime for money, for weapons, and for political support. And we have to understand that the Muslim Brotherhood is inimical to our Western way of life, our American values, our American Constitution, our freedoms. They want to have a worldwide Islamic Sharia system. They want to take away our freedoms. And this is something that we absolutely cannot allow to happen. We must be aware. Watch what is going on. Sudan is important. The civil war could have really catastrophic implications if it's not slowed down. And again, it shows that the Iranians have not given up. They might have lost that 12-day war, but they're still trying to spread their evil doctrine and their money and their weapons throughout the region.
Well, we're certainly going to keep a focus on the Muslim Brotherhood here, but we'll continue on with the final story that I'd like to talk to you about. I alluded to it a little bit earlier, a larger story coming out in the week, and that is the assassination of Charlie Kirk. This is something that has really affected quite a few of us, and I just wanted to give you a chance to give your thoughts on this subject.
Well, you know, like so many of us, Rick, I've been in a state of shock when I heard this. Charlie is somebody who lived for dialogue. He lived for his faith. And the murderer tried to shut down dialogue and essentially denied that faith as well. Charlie was the age of my youngest son. I mean, I guess I must have met him early on in his career because he was promoted by David Horowitz, and we met at one of the restoration weekends where I was a frequent speaker. And Charlie, I think he must have been 18 or 20 years old, very, very young at the time. And yet already You could see his passion, and you could see why David was promoting him as a youth leader. Look at what he created with Turning Point USA. I mean, just absolutely astonishing. This, you know, broad-based youth movement came out as pro-Trump, bringing young people into the MAGA movement, and out of love, not out of hate, as his political adversaries have been accusing him of. That's what's, to me, really shocking, Rick. You look on the left, you look at some of the comments on social media, the people who said, well, he deserved to be killed. And these are school teachers. One guy in the U.S. military who has a big TikTok following. You have anesthesiologists, you have doctors, you have nurses, you have people from all walks of life, your neighbors, if you wish. Charlie Kirk deserved to be murdered? I mean, it's truly shocking. It's truly shocking. Look, I listened to the Utah Governor Cox on Friday morning when they got the killer, and he gave a very impassioned speech, really, at the end. And he said, this assassination of Charlie Kirk could be a turning point in our nation's history, but in which direction? It's unclear at this point. Are we going towards our better angels? Will we speak with one another again from across that political divide? Or are we becoming increasingly divided and increasingly violent? And I've got to tell you, when I see what's going on social media, it's not clear we're going in the right direction here, Rick.
It certainly isn't. But one thing that is clear is that this is a fallen world and it needs our prayer. And that's something that should be emphasized at this moment. Well, Ken, as always, we appreciate your insight informing us on what is going on in the world. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Rick. And I just can't imagine, what's going on with Erica Kirk and her two young children. It just breaks my heart.
Great job as always, Ken. And yes, we'll keep the Kirk family in our prayers. And I think one thing, Ken, that you've always brought to our attention is persecution of Christians around the world. And I think if you look at what's taking place in Africa, many people are being beheaded in churches by the Muslim Brotherhood. And we need to be very aware. And let's keep Christians in prayer all around the world. We got to take a break. And when we come back, David Dolan with our Middle East news update. Right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
I'm Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. In Jerusalem, at least 6 people are dead and over a dozen injured after 2 gunmen opened fire at a bus stop. It's the deadliest attack on Israel's capital in years. Pastor Israel Pakhtar with Beit Hillel Congregation says, amid tragedy and war, Israeli Christians are offering Jesus' comfort. In a few months, the church will open its new Evangelism and Discipleship Center in Ashdod.
We have more and more people getting saved, coming to the Lord, discovering Jesus. So this new Evangelism Discipleship facility allowed us to reach out to people when they come to us and share the gospel. And also discipleship. We need a venue for Bible school, for trainings, for leadership training, for pastors training, for youth.
Pray for people across Israel to seek hope in Jesus Christ. And Syria re-enters the global energy market with its first official crude export in 14 years. Earlier this year, the U.S. lifted sanctions, sparking renewed interest in Syria's energy sector and foreign investment. In a similar way, new doors are opening for gospel work. Mark with Global Catalytic Ministry says,
Syria has opened up, and because it's now accessible for the first time in decades, we are starting work in Damascus. We're going to be spreading to the north and to the south, building disciple-making communities, starting to see house churches formed, starting to see baptisms happen.
Many Christians from Muslim backgrounds are eager to share the good news, but don't know how to begin. Global Catalytic Ministries equips Muslim background believers in underground churches across the Middle East. You're listening to Mission Network News, a service of One Way Ministries. How does radio share the hope of Christ worldwide? This month, Transworld Radio is offering a free book called Making Waves. It's filled with powerful stories of transformed lives and God's fingerprints in action. Get your free copy when you click on the banner ad at missionnetworknews.org. I'm Ruth Kramer.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today Radio, the program that looks at current events in the light of Bible prophecy. Well, this is the portion of our program. We call it our Middle East News Update. We look at news coming out of the Middle East in general, but Israel in particular. To do that, we have with us journalist Dave Dolan. Dave, thanks for being with us today.
I'm always blessed to be with you, Rick.
Well, David, we typically start out these reports with a report on what took place in the previous week. This was certainly an eventful week. Can you give us the latest?
Yes, Rick. There was important news absolutely every day of this week in Israel. It began with a Houthi missile attack upon the international airport near the southern Israeli port city of Eilat, a very popular tourist destination for especially Europeans, although, of course, a lot less in the last 2 years. That was followed by more Houthi missile attacks during the week, and one aimed at the Jerusalem area, but they got it shot down before it hit. There were more drone attacks, and the IDF did some more major responses in Sana'a and other parts of faraway Yemen. In fact, they announced that one of the missions in the south of the country was the longest Israeli jets have ever flown in an active mission in the IDF's history, the Israeli Air Force history, well over 1,000 miles. Then, of course, on Tuesday, we had the worst terrorist atrocity in some time strike Israel, North Jerusalem, and the remote junction, an area I lived near for several years and know very well. 6 Israeli civilians killed. One woman who was 60, very well known, worked with the B'nai Akiva youth movement. She was a leader in it for many years, so she knew thousands of people and political leaders and whatever within the country, well-loved. And then someone also quite famous, known only as Dr. Mark. That wasn't his real name, a Pennsylvania-born Israeli, an American immigrant. And he started a bakery near Jerusalem 25, 30 years ago. I was there at the time. And he called his products Dr. Mark, and that's what he was known as throughout the country because they were health food products, the first ever introduced into Israel, healthy breads with all the different ingredients, and those items are still sold all over the country. So everyone knew him. He was an elderly man, 79. Then, of course, Hamas took, quote, credit for that two-man terrible machine gun attack on 2 buses and a bus stop that left a pregnant woman with a bullet in her leg and many others wounded and 6 dead. That was claimed by Hamas. So the next day, the IDF was ordered into Doha, Qatar. And of course, that was quite a historic event, Israel launching an attack in yet another Arab country that is housing Hamas or Hezbollah or Islamic Jihad, the various groups in Iraq. So now Doha, Qatar. Of course, the Qatari leadership was livid and made that very clear and said they would suspend any involvement in negotiations to release the remaining Israeli hostages. Hamas claimed that none of its senior leaders that were apparently being targeted, they were meeting together to discuss the proposal that the U.S. was making. They say none of them were killed, but Khalil al-Hayya, who's the leading leader that was at the gathering, he did not appear at his son's funeral. His son was killed in the attack. He was a lower ranking official, and he didn't even show up at his funeral on Thursday in Doha. So that was significant. And there are reports today that he was severely wounded, this leader. Of course, we had, Rick, and you'll recall, other Hamas leaders were killed, Israel claimed, and Hamas originally said no or said nothing, and later we found out it was true, so we'll have to wait on that. Then on Thursday, we had the Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, and other top cabinet leaders and other officials meet in the city of Ma'ale Adumim, just east of Jerusalem. That was to sign an accord authorizing the E1 settlement project, some are calling it, or neighborhood expansion, whatever. 3,000 homes are to be built in that area. 15 to 20,000 people are expected to be living there within 10 years. There's a problem. There's a little Arab village in the center of the area that they want to build. So there's going to have to be some work on that. But Bibi made a speech at the ceremony. He said, there will be no Palestinian state. And of course, the criticism of this agreement by many in the world, et cetera, was that it prevents a contiguous Palestinian state that would connect the northern Samaria region with the southern Judea area of the West Bank. And this new growth east of Jerusalem would basically cut that prospect out. It would be a Jewish settlement all the way across to the Jordan Valley. So on Friday, we had the UN vote. on a resolution sponsored by France and the Saudis to declare a Palestinian state, to support a Palestinian state. And the vote was overwhelming. I think it was 142 countries voted for that. The United States, of course, Israel and Venezuela and Hungary were among several countries that voted against it, but only about 12, I think, and around 10 abstained. So that was passed. And then we had a terror attack also on Friday in a kibbutz near Jerusalem. Palestinian with a knife stabbed two Israelis at a hotel on Kibbutz Suba. I've been there several times, had friends that live there, but fortunately neither was killed, but they are in serious condition, and they were able to find the man that did it and take him. Then finally, Rick, I'll end on this. We had the Prime Minister making a statement on Charlie Kirk's tragic assassination in Utah during the week. He called him a lion-hearted friend of Israel who was murdered for speaking truth and defending freedom. He said he stood tall for Judeo-Christian civilization, and he said that he had invited him personally to meet with him in Jerusalem in just a few weeks. He phoned him a couple of weeks ago, Netanyahu said, and spoke with him, had a very high regard for him. And the Israeli press on Friday, Rick, was filled with tributes to him, even though, of course, he was quite a strong Christian. He was very appreciated for his outspoken support for Israel and for helping to change the minds of a lot of young people on campuses in particular that were being fed. Well, we know what they've been fed the past couple of years.
Well, that is certainly true. And we will be talking with a few more people who knew Charlie Kirk, and we're going to talk about that situation as well. Such a tragic situation. And we appreciate Prime Minister Netanyahu's comments on that. But I want to go back to another thing that Prime Minister Netanyahu said. And you talk about the fact that there will be no Palestinian state, talking about these E1 settlements, and that prevents a contiguous Palestinian state. But if we put this in context, we look at October 7th, and the Palestinian people had an autonomous area there that they used as a launching platform for an attack on Israel. So when Prime Minister Netanyahu says there's not going to be a Palestinian state, he's basically looking to protect his country and to protect the right of Israel to exist, isn't he?
Well, Rick, it was only in 2009 that he was still publicly supporting the establishment of a Palestinian state. In a speech, very controversial speech, I covered it at Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv, he said, we have to accept the fact that they are going to get a state eventually, and we just have to work out the details. And at the time, that was the prevailing view in the country. But now it's obviously not. Now the opinion polls all show two-thirds at least of all Israelis, I would say, acknowledge, or maybe even stronger, realize that a Palestinian state cannot be established right next to Jerusalem, right above Tel Aviv, or even in the south in Gaza, because it will be a hostile state. You're not going to erase Islam, you're not going to erase hundreds of years of conflict, you're not going to erase the theology that all these groups, both inside of Israel, in the territories, in the whole Middle East, and of course, all around the world, including the new mayor of New York, it looks like, with an anti-Israel feeling that Israel shouldn't be there, shouldn't exist. So they're going to continue war. What can Israel do? I mean, can they allow such a state under these circumstances? Well, like you said, they had the potential for a full state in Gaza, Rick. Had Hamas not taken over, and had the PA really moderated itself, had it really brought law and order, had it really brought jobs and all the things that a government is supposed to do instead of spending all its money, aid money on underground tunnels and rockets and missiles and things, then we would have had a Palestinian state in effect. And then, had it been successful and peaceful, it could have expanded to the Arab-controlled areas. About 40% of Judea and Samaria is under PA control in one form or another. and there's different levels. Then they would have allowed it. That was the feeling up until October 7th. There was still not a majority, but a lot of Israelis that still supported the concept of a two-state solution. Now hardly anyone does, because the reality on the ground is Israel has an enemy that's not in any way prepared to live in peace with it.
Dave Dolan reporting for Prophecy Today. Dave, as always, we appreciate your Middle East news update, letting us know what is going on in Israel. Thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
You're always welcome, Rick. God bless.
Great job as always, David. We're going to unpack a little bit more of this with Winky Medad coming up in the next half hour, but pertaining to future prophecies, the borders of the land of Israel and nations coming against Israel. We'll take a look at that later on in the program. We've got to take a break right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
I'm Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. Nepal's Gen Z protests on Monday and Tuesday left many government buildings in the capital in shambles. The military enforced a curfew on Wednesday, restoring some order. Conversations between military officials and young protest leaders have begun. John Podaiti with Bibles for the World says the ministry is looking to renew its gospel work in Nepal. Pray that Nepal's young generation will discover the true life that God offers. Pray also that this political crisis will bring greater spiritual unity among Nepal's Christians. And life's uncertainties can be blinding when truth is restricted. Christians in Iran wrestle with ideological war, freedom, and survival. Lana Silk with Transform Iran says the program War or Peace, Win or Lose offers prayer, biblical teaching, and practical help for the church. Iranians watch safely by satellite, though the government watches too. Find your place in the story at missionnews.org. Mission Network News, a service of One Way Ministries. I'm Ruth Kramer.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with Rick, we're examining current events in the light of God's prophetic word. We're going to continue talking about Israel with Israel Medad, affectionately known as Winky Medad, lives out there in Shiloh. I can picture where he lives. Rick, let's bring in Winky and find out. Let's go a little bit further and what we need to as far as this last week in Israel.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. I have Winky Medad with us. He's a frequent guest on the program. He's a columnist, a commentator. And Winky, if I'm not mistaken, your wife fell asleep in your home, which is where I'm talking to you right now. So you're sitting outside willing to do that to talk with us. Thanks for doing that.
I thank you for having me on. My wife has finished her cooking for the Shabbat, but my soup, as everybody here knows listening in, is still simmering.
Well, we won't keep you too long, but we just wanted to talk a little bit about the things that took place in Israel this week. And I know it's been a very tumultuous week around the world and certainly there in Israel as well. A terror attack earlier in the week and then a response by Israel. But I want to go back to that terror attack. You take the public transportation, you take buses there when you go to Jerusalem or when you travel in Israel often. I know that. Can you just tell us? That seems to be one of the bigger attacks we've had in a little while, and I'm wondering if that's changed the mood in the country at all, or is this just the reality of life there?
Well, first of all, I want to point out that everybody in that area are civilians. In other words, I think I've repeated this many times in the program, a lot of people call Israel immoral, but if you take a look at the past, I won't go back 100 years, okay? Let's go back 20, 30 years. 99% of all Arab terror attacks, what they call resistance, is targeting civilians who really have very little to do with the occupation or repression, so to say, of the Arab population. And in this case, for those who don't know, there is just on the outskirts of Jerusalem, there's a religious neighborhood called Ramot. It's a very large area. I think they must have about 30,000 or more people there. And that sort of bus stop is a major place where everybody gets off buses and get on buses. You could, most of the time during the morning, you get 50 to 100 people just standing around waiting for all the buses that go into the city. So they didn't attack the army. They didn't attack the police. I mean, anybody's read history of resistance and underground movements, including the Irgun and the Stern Group, know that they attack police stations, army camps, etc. And this is just horrific because it means that they're attacking Jews. They're attacking civilians, not attacking representatives of the occupation regime, to quote their terminology. And so, yes, I mean, I take, as you said, I take the buses, I take the light rail. We've had attacks on the light rail, from stone throwing to stabbings to shootings. And this goes on, I'm not going to say all the time, but unfortunately, it's not an irregular phenomenon. And people looking from the outside, from the president of Spain to the president of, or to the prime minister of Great Britain, really do not understand what's going on the ground here.
Well, and Winky, let me just follow up on that question. When we watch the news here in the United States, or really around the world, we hear these other countries commentating on this. Hamas is fighting a war that they started by attacking civilians, and now they're fighting the war by hiding amongst their own civilian population. The fundamental difference between what Israel is doing, who is taking casualties, trying to protect that civilian population, but being accused of genocide, that fundamental difference could not be more clear. And it's just an indication of the slant of the news media, isn't it?
I will make it even more clearer for you, to give you a good reason why continue to have me on. Hamas is trying to prevent the people leaving Gaza City going south so they can escape any of the hostilities. They're trying to make them stay behind so they can hide among them. In other words, it's not that they're hiding among them. They're not even letting them leave in many cases. And the IDF had to set up a special phone number for Gazans who are caught at road blockades by Hamas or something like that. They can call up and the IDF will try to release them from their being blockaded. I mean, this has not been heard before in civilization in the midst of a war. And so it's so frustrating. I mean, when we do something wrong, when our targets are non-identified or misidentified, if a shell goes wrong, we immediately admit it, right? And we're being painted in the world's media, among college kids, among professors, among even some church leaders, as the most evil people on earth, when it's just the wrong story.
It certainly is. Well, in response to the attack that took place, there was a seemingly an immediate response by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the IDF, and that was to attempt to eliminate Hamas leadership in Qatar. Could you talk a little bit about that, attacking a place that they have not attacked before? Is this a change, a fundamental shift in the way things are going on in that region right now? Or do you think this is going to be a major incident or not?
Well, everything has the potential of becoming a major incident, unfortunately, both because of Qatar, both because of President Trump, both because future meetings maybe next week with Arab states or whatever they call their Association of Arab States now. I can't remember all the names all the time. But of course, what immediately, before I return to the subject, what immediately gets forgotten is, why is Qatar hosting the high command of a terrorist group and engaged in being the mediator between that terrorist group and Israel in order to try to get the hostages released? I mean, that doesn't make sense. They're an interested party. They're funding Hamas. They're putting them up in houses. They're giving them a little bit of protection. They're funding Al Jazeera, which is the main sort of media arm that helps out Hamas. And between you and me, in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars or more over the years, they are funding academic institutions in the United States, which must hire certain Arab or Muslim professors and lecturers. And as I saw, caught an item about a week and a half ago, they're not allowed, these colleges, to criticize the royal family of Qatar. In other words, our universities, the so-called liberal institutions of free speech and free thinking, are being paid by Qatar to shut up. This is the reality that we have in the so-called woke kingdom of America at the present moment, which is not only horrendous for Israel, speaking here as someone very much interested in Israel's future, but as I always try to point out, for your future as well in America.
Speaking of America, there supposedly this attack was carried out without any foreknowledge by the United States, including President Trump. And some people say this might have damaged the Israeli relationship with the Trump administration. Can you talk a little bit about this? Is there a worry that this might be the case?
I'm worried that it might be the case. I'm worried about the case that Mr. Trump did not realize the importance of Qatar in the terrorist structure. We have a problem there because Mr. Witkoff himself is a business partner with several Qataris, or he has been in the past. Let me be a little bit more circumspect in my words. He did a real estate deal in New York City with the Qataris or with a Qatari company. So things can get very, very complicated here in dealing with the Middle East. And we would like to hope that the people around Mr. Trump have a clear picture of what's going on. I'm almost positive that Mr. Netanyahu at least briefed him in the past that these type of operations are on the table. There's a certain limit that we can go in sitting on our hands, to use the phrase. But when Hamas is moving into Jerusalem, when Hamas is coming over the fences near Tel Aviv, in other words, going through the employees' gaps in the fences and coming to work in Israel, we have a country and a citizenry that we have to take care of. And so that, of course, is uppermost in our minds. It means saving people's lives and not just saving people's money. And so I'm sure this will work out because there are clear and level-headed heads there in Washington, and it'll come out okay.
Final question I have for you today, Winky. In full disclosure, you are sitting out there, as you said, on the front steps of your home. You're in the area of Shiloh, which is in the area of Judea and Samaria. Now, that's what we call it. That's what the Bible calls it. But that is also the area known as the West Bank. And some interesting news coming out about the West Bank this week. Prime Minister Netanyahu, in a ceremony that marked the signing of the new homes being built there around Jerusalem and what they call that E1 corridor, I believe is what it's called. Prime Minister Netanyahu said, quote, "There will never be a Palestinian state," unquote. Very interesting words, and some might say he's just recognizing reality. Others might say that this is kind of a change in policy. Can you talk about this statement?
Well, I think he's always been, to use a phrase, very much non-pro-Palestine state. But he's been under pressure. He's been under pressure since 2009, when under pressure of Barack Obama, he had to make that statement that I recognize the possibility of a Palestinian state if it is demilitarized, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, that didn't help things out. None of the attempts to tell the Arabs that they have a possibility of some sort of self-government, which is less than a Palestinian state. And I remind us all, as you know, I am also an historian, right, that in 1995 in October, Yitzhak Rabin said the same thing. He said, we are saying we want something just short of a Palestinian state, some sort of entity that has as much autonomy and control of its own administration and its own populace, but not a free state. Why not a free state? It's not because we're against a state. It's because we know they're going to hook up with Iran. They're going to hook up with the Iraqi militias. They're going to hook up with Hezbollah or what's left of it. And this is the danger, because once it's a state, I mean, right now we're in trouble because it's not a state. Can you imagine if it's a state and we have to do something and then everything gets blown up in the United Nations and the news? Israel is attacking the state of Palestine. So we had to be very careful over the years. And it's, I think recently Mr. Netanyahu is coming out a little bit more stronger, saying this hasn't developed the way we wanted it to. We don't think it is going to develop the way we wanted it to. And we have to doubt very much the ability of the Palestinian Authority and its rival, the Hamas, to rule themselves and to keep the security of Israel within bounds of regular relationships between states. And now he's going to be pushing Mahmoud Abbas and anybody else who's around a little bit more because, first of all, Abbas is getting very, very old. I think he's about 88 plus, and we don't want to run into any sort of problems with any future leaders.
Winky Medad reporting to us from his home there in Shiloh, Israel. As always, we appreciate you coming to us today. Now, we give you permission to very quietly sneak back into the house so you don't wake up your wife and continue making your soup as is your weekly ritual. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us today. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
And from the steps of the Medad household, I thank you very much for having me on. Goodbye to you and our listeners.
Great job, as always, Winky. Well, this last week, little did we know that when we booked Bill Federer, that we would know what would happen during the week and that Bill Federer was very close to Charlie Kirk. Rick, you have Bill on the line right now. Let's talk to Bill and about this young man, Charlie Kirk, that was killed this last week.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. I have Bill Federer. He's a good friend of the programs. He's the author of the American Minute radio program. He's a speaker and author. He talks about kind of the intersection between history in the United States here and Christianity. Bill, thanks for being on the program today.
Great to be with you.
Well, on this program, we look at current events in the light of Bible prophecy, and there are so many current events going on as we relate to what is going to happen to Bible prophecy. But today, I wanted to step back a little bit. An event that took place this past week, the killing of a young man, a father, a husband, Charlie Kirk, shot to death in Utah this week. If you could, I know that you did know him, and I know that you, I'm sure, have some thoughts on this, and you can help us put it into some type of context from an American perspective, but most importantly, from a Christian perspective. Can you tell us your thoughts on this story?
Yeah, well, I didn't get any sleep last night, and I've known Charlie since February 22nd, 2014. I was the main speaker in Robinson, Illinois at their civic center, about 500 people, and I get in there, and there's a warm-up speaker, and he was so good, I couldn't concentrate on my notes. I usually look over my notes before I speak. It was Charlie Kirk, and he talked about how a friend of his, Bill Montgomery, said, I'll pay for you to take a year off before you go to college to go give talks, and he did, and that was the beginning of Turning Point. We had a mutual friend, Foster Freeze, who was a conservative billionaire. He supported me when I ran for Congress 20 years ago, and Charlie, you know, talks about how he met Foster in a political event and followed him up the stairways and gave him his 2-minute pitch. And Foster said, okay, I'll call my office and I'll cut you a check. And that helped fund the beginning of Turning Point. A friend of mine, Pastor Rob McCoy, asked me to speak at a church service in California, January of 2020 with Charlie Kirk. And my connecting flight landed in Las Vegas, and they canceled my connecting flight. So I had to rent a car, drive across the Mojave Desert at 2 o'clock in the morning with a million stars. But I made it to the church service right when it was starting. I met Erica, his fiance, now his wife. She's a former Miss Arizona. But we were friends throughout the years. One time we spent a couple hours in a car together at Foster Freeze's funeral, driving through the Wyoming mountains. And talking history, and Charlie was thrilled that he was able to stump me on a history fact. He goes, I knew something Bill Federer did. And Rob McCoy was starting Turning Point Faith with Charlie and asked me to move out to Phoenix. And my wife and I had just moved to Florida, and so she declined that offer. That's one of those things you look back in history and wonder if you should have gone out there anyway. But Charlie asked me to speak at a big Freedom Night where there were thousands of people at the Dream Center Church there in Phoenix, Pastor Luke Barnett. And I've spoken at his conferences throughout the years. And then 2022, he flew me out and to talk about Turning Point Education. And so we agreed to do that. And so I produce a weekly video. But they have a great team, Hutz Hertzberg, putting together curriculum for homeschools, classical schools, charter schools, micro schools. But I remember being at that dinner with Charlie, and Pastor Rob McCoy asked him what he was doing that weekend, and he goes, I'm fasting this weekend. I need to get God's direction for something. I thought, wow, here he is fasting. And then he would text me scriptures, you know, just out of the blue, from the Bible. And some of them were, you know, I went through my texts just to see if I still had them on there, and I do. But one of them, December 2nd, 2024, Charlie texted Jeremiah 30, you know, "But I will restore you to health, heal your wounds, declares the Lord." February 16th, 2025, Zephaniah 3:17, "The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you with love, exalt over you with loud singing." Charlie texted March 12th, 2025, Isaiah 26:3, "You keep him in perfect peace, his mind is stayed on you because he trusts in you." April 20th of this year, he texted me Romans 10:9, "Because if you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus, believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved." And then he adds, "Let's share the truth of the resurrection daily with boldness and love. God bless you, my friend."
Incredible recollections of your time with Charlie. And it's my understanding you were just with him last week in South Korea, weren't you?
Yeah, so Seoul, Korea has a Turning Point equivalent called Build Up Korea, because they have a new pro-communist president who's arresting pastors. And so Charlie and I were over there speaking at this event. They had thousands of people. And then we're backstage, and the reporter's there. And there's an interpreter, Mina Kim. And he's saying, you know, "Oh, you know, when Trump got elected, that must have been the happiest time of your life." And he goes, "No, that was the fourth happiest. Marrying my wife, Erica, was the first, and then my two kids. And so Trump's fourth." And Pastor Rob McCoy on the other side of the room says, "Don't forget Jesus." And then Charlie quickly corrects his answer to the reporter. He says, "The happiest moment of my life was giving my life to Jesus. And my wife second and kids third. So Trump's down at fifth." But I thought here, it was 5 days ago. But he talked about the happiest time of his life. And then less than 24 hours before he got shot, he texted me 1 Corinthians 16:9. "For a wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries." And I'm still in shock myself personally, but I can't help to remember Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, where he talks about being met on the battlefield of the Great War to decide whether this nation or any nation dedicated to equality and freedom shall long endure. And then he ends by saying, "It's up to us, the living, to keep the freedoms." And so that's why I think that even though he's not with us, he's in heaven, we need to remember these words. And so this is Lincoln: "It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work for which they thus far so nobly carried on. It's rather for us to be dedicated to the great task remaining for us that these honored dead," which now includes Charlie Kirk, "that we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave their last full measure of devotion." And he was answering questions. Shortly before he got shot, he talked about Jesus being the Son of God. If you saw that whole interview, the question-answer time, "that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth."
Well, Bill, I did not realize the extent of your relationship with Charlie Kirk. I do now, and I appreciate you sharing that. But I wanted to ask you one final question before I let you go. Charlie Kirk was certainly an effective political operator. He was a major player, actually, and was, a lot of people said, had a big role in getting President Trump reelected. But he was also a Christian, and you shared about that, and he was very upfront about his faith, and he was willing to share his faith and even live his faith out. And as we look at, we're going to be finding out more about the shooter and how that all came about, I'm wondering, maybe it's less about his political views and more about him being an outspoken Christian. Can you talk about what role you think that played in his death?
Well, I think there's a very anti-Christian movement going on the left and globally. You read about, you know, the Hindus cracking down on Christians, the communists cracking down on Christians, the Islamic world cracking down on Christians. In America, we've basically had a couple hundred year reprieve from the norm. And it's because Christians founded the country and had safeguards. But because Christians have bought into this, don't get involved. Who's going to be involved if we're not? It's non-Christians. And what are they going to do? They're going to do non-Christian stuff. And so they've been pushing their agenda. And the trans agenda is simply anti-Christian agenda. They call it trans, but it's just anti-Christian agenda. And criminalize it if you don't support that. And Charlie took a stand. And so there's a swath of these trans killers that have a confused hatred. But I think that, you know, we have to at some point recognize that all of us have a limited time on Earth. And we go through times of testing basically to show whose side we're on. And it's like a romance novel. And maybe a couple guys are courting a girl, and then it's the big night, and she's got her dress, and she's all excited, and the one guy calls and says, I can't make it tonight, got a business meeting, you'll understand, won't you? And then there's this other guy that's willing to crawl across glass to spend a few minutes with her, and it's like, you know what, this crisis shows who really loves the girl and who doesn't. And I think sometimes we can have lip service to the Lord, but sometimes when we go through the crises and we say, okay, Jesus, I'm all in, and in my life is yours, that's when we really show that we believe in him. And I think Charlie demonstrated that. And I think Pastor Rob McCoy, his pastor, encouraged him. And he became more and more outspoken in his faith as the couple last 5 years that I've known him. He's gotten really bold. And I'm just so proud of him. And I text him and encourage him after a talk and for sharing his faith boldly. His rallies that he would have in Phoenix, the last night he would have a praise band. 1 year he had Kim Walker Smith, and they had 3,000 young people singing praise songs. And that had never happened before. But it's like he decided that he's going to put this in the forefront. And I'm just so proud of him, and I know that he's. I saw somebody did an AI of Charlie walking up the steps into heaven, and Jesus is greeting him, and then he's turning his head back, and he's passing a baton to all these young hands that are reaching up, and I think that my prayer is that a whole lot of young people will realize that he started when he was a teenager. 18 years old, and by 31, he had impacted the entire world. And the same God that he served, we serve, and the same Holy Spirit that was in him is in us. And so I just speak encouragement to every young person. You know, we go through a period of grief, but let this be an encouragement that you can do it too. Charlie would want you to know that you can do it too. So be bold, be courageous. This is your hour. We don't know when any of us are going to be called home, but let's make every moment count for the Lord. And then a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. We want to leave a country. So I coined a quote, and Charlie repeated it in the last talk he gave when we were in South Korea together. And it's the most important thing is to bring people to Christ, and the second most important thing is to preserve the freedom to do the most important thing. That we need to be involved preserving the freedoms that we have to share the gospel.
Bill Federer from the AmericanMinute.com. Bill, we so appreciate you sharing your recollections, your time with Charlie, but also that exhortation given to those of us that remain here on the earth, our job to share the gospel. Thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
God bless you.
Thank you, Bill, for taking the time to be with us on the program. And at the end of the program today, Rick and I will take a look at the book where we will talk about how to be prepared for these events that will take place in the future. We'll be right back here on Prophecy Today Weekend. Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. And along with my brother Rick, we examine current events in the light of God's prophetic word.
That's right, Jimmy. And we've had a great program today as we've talked to our broadcast partners. And so important that we are able to bring you this message. And Jimmy, you know, this is this program, this ministry, it's a labor of love for both you and I. And we love to do it. And we appreciate the supporters that help allow us to do it. Many of you out there with your prayers and your financial support help to keep this ministry going. And we just like to take this moment to tell you that you are needed. And we appreciate that. And to thank you as well. Thanks for all you do to help to keep this program coming to you every week.
Yes, and all you need to do is go to prophecytoday.com and you'll be able to find the donate button and you can help our ministry. We deeply appreciate it. I think it's needed much more than ever now, Rick. I know this last weekend up in Farmington, Maine, the people there love prophecy teaching, so it does help us to get out, and we've got many more meetings coming along the way. Well, in our legacy series this week with Dr. Jimmy DeYoung, in our last study of the book of Revelation, we concluded talking about Babylon. Remember, Dr. DeYoung told you the last thing that happens before Jesus Christ comes back to the earth will be Babylon is destroyed. And many of you say Babylon was destroyed 2,500 years ago, as recorded in Daniel chapter 5. But what we know is that was the destruction of the Babylonian Empire, not the city of Babylon. Just a few moments, we will discuss the passage found in Revelation 18 about how Babylon will be destroyed. However, we must begin this study. We will be looking at two chapters in the book of Revelation. I want you to take your Bible and turn to Revelation chapters 17 and 18. These two chapters cover the entire seven-year period of time known as the tribulation. It's an intense time of judgment on the earth that happens right after the rapture of the church. In both of these chapters, we will see the word Babylon. Remember, Daniel chapter 5 is the record of the fall of the Babylonian Empire. More on that in just a moment. Right now, let's begin our study in Revelation chapter 17. Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and the Legacy Series.
Right here, chapter 17, in the first 3.5 years, unfolds. That is a false church. Verse 5 of chapter 17 says, Babylon, the mother of harlots, established this false religiosity. It was a mother-son cult that was established 4,500 years ago at Babel. You might remember chapter 11, verse 4 of the book of Genesis. Let us build us a tower whose top may reach into heaven. That's a religious terminology. A tower topping and going into heaven? No way it was going to do that. Nimrod had a wife, her name was Semiramis. They had a son, his name was Tammuz. They became the co-equal recipients of a mother-son cult evil worship. They're both talked about in the Bible. Jeremiah chapters 7 and 44 calls her the Queen of Heaven. And they celebrated with a very interesting agenda. They would make hot cross buns to celebrate her special holy day. They would take hard-boiled eggs and paint them up in beautiful colors and lay them out in the woods for the children to go find. And they did this on a ungodly holy day called Ishtar. Sound familiar? In Jeremiah 7, God says to Jeremiah, don't even pray for these people that worship like that. Their son, Tammuz, he's mentioned in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 8, when God brings Ezekiel back to Israel, shows him all the idolatry that's going on. He sees a convent of virgins worshiping Tammuz, the son of the mother-son cult. With the fall of the Babylonian Empire, 539 BC, that mother-son cult changed its location from Babylon. You know where it moved to? Pergamos. Pergamos, oh yeah, that's that third church in Revelation chapter 2. Pergamos is the location, and Judy and I could take you. We've been there a number of times. We could take you. We could show you the statues of the Roman emperors. They were called Caesars. That was their political title. But at that time in history, they were deified, and so they were given a religious title. You know what the religious title was? Pontifex Maximus. And that was too long. That means major keeper of the bridge. So they shortened it to Pontiff. And that was too long, so they shortened it to Pope. Now, don't you dare go out of here and say, I've just been preaching against the Catholic Church. I haven't said the word Catholic at all. I'm telling you what happened in history. Chapter 17 says, these people that worship this false religiosity will wear purple and scarlet. They will carry a chalice full of blood and a cross made out of diamonds and pearls. They have a convent of virgins that serve them. Oh, by the way, this false mother-son cult headquartered in Pergamos, and then they moved to Rome, Italy, which chapter 17, verse 9 says, "And here is a mind which hath wisdom, the seven heads," and that's what they saw, the beast and the whore. That's the word used in the scriptures referring to a false church. What's the opposite of a whore? A beautiful virgin bride. That's what we are, the bride of Christ. He said, "I saw its seven heads are seven mountains in which the woman sitteth." The false church will be headquartered in the city of Rome in the first 3.5 years. Look what's going to happen here. Verse 16, "The 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire." They're going to wipe out the false church at the midway point of the tribulation. I told you when we looked at Ezekiel, Islam will be wiped out so that activity can take place, and they wipe out this false church. Look at verse 17. "For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will." God puts in the hearts of evil men to accomplish his will. What happens after the first 3.5 years? The false church is destroyed. Where's the Antichrist go? Chapter 11, verse 1 says, "John, measure the place for the temple." What happens? The Antichrist walks into the Holy of Holies, claims to be God. That's the abomination of desolation. They put up a statue, Revelation chapter 13, verses 15 and following. They put up a statue. It's made to talk, and it's made to move, and the world is caused to worship it by the miracles that the false prophet performs. And then where does the Antichrist go? Since there's a statue in the temple, he doesn't need to be there. He goes to Babylon, chapter 18. Look at chapter 18. "And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lighted with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen. And you can study down through here, and you can talk about the merchants. The merchants waxed rich, and with the destruction of Babylon, they weep. Look at verse 10, "standing afar off for the fear of their torment, saying, Alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour, thy judgment has come." Verse 17, "For in 1 hour so great riches have come to naught." How does he set it up? You know, Revelation chapter 13, verses 16 and 17, he says, every man, every woman, everybody who wants to buy or sell during this last 3.5 years has to have a identification mark. We talk about the mark of the beast. What is it? 666? I don't know. It's on the forehead. It's on the back of the hand. Is it a computer chip? I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. I don't speculate. But it's an identification mark. How in the world can we get everybody to take an identification mark to buy or sell? I got an idea. Let's have a worldwide financial crisis. And let's have the G20 come together and set up a global economic structure, which is exactly what G20, China, Russia, United Nations is calling for as we stand here. And so everybody takes a mark, identification mark. They can buy or sell. And this is all headquartered in the city of Babylon. Well, I thought Babylon was destroyed. No, Babylon wasn't destroyed. The Babylonian Empire, chapter 5 of the book of Daniel, was destroyed. But I want to tell you, Ezra chapter 7 says, 75 years after the fall of the Babylonian Empire, Ezra was living in Babylon. He traveled 5 months to get to Jerusalem to become the one who reinstituted the temple practices. You ever read about Alexander the Great? 200 years after the fall of the Babylonian Empire, he headquartered his Grecian Empire in Babylon. Babylon has not been destroyed, I know. You know how I know? I watch CNN. And I saw the CNN cameras in Babylon the other day. It was a multinational headquarters for a peacekeeping organization. 21 nations headed up by the Polish. Babylon has never been destroyed. It must be destroyed. How do I know it has to be destroyed? Isaiah 13 and 14, Jeremiah 50 and 51, Ezekiel tells us Babylon will be destroyed. Revelation, it says right there, the last of the 21 judgments, Babylon is destroyed. Greatest earthquake to hit the face of the earth. Why? Because the Babylonians burned down the temple of God and took the implements and desecrated them. Chapter 5 of Daniel. Why do you think the United States military went into Babylon, Iraq, because Babylon had to be prepared for prophecy to be fulfilled? Oh, what caused us to go in was Saddam Hussein. He was going into Jerusalem. You may not know this. 7 million man army, Saddam Hussein was going to lead into Jerusalem to liberate, give it to the Palestinians. All of them had weapons training. 2,000 of them were volunteers to be suicide bombers. The Israeli Defense Force went on high alert. Judy and I were living there then. We were there for 39 scuds from Iraq. We knew Saddam meant business. Benjamin Netanyahu said, Iraq is now putting in place a state-of-the-art, cutting-edge telecommunication system. Oil is running out in Saudi Arabia and Iran. The greatest oil sources in the world are under the earth in Iraq. They've only touched 2%. They'll become the richest nation of the world. And that'll set the place for Babylon to be set up and the Antichrist. You know what the last thing that will happen is before he comes back to earth? The Lord destroys Babylon. And then he steps down on earth. Daniel, parents of Antichrist. Ezekiel, the temple in the tribulation. Revelation, Babylon in power, destroyed, and Christ comes back. And all three events could happen within days. We're here before it all starts, and we go to the heavenlies. These are the keys to unlocking God's plan for the future. Be a watchman. Warn the people and live in light of these truths.
Revelation 16:18 says that the greatest earthquake to ever hit the earth will be used to destroy Babylon. It is stronger than any earthquake that has ever happened on this earth throughout all of history. This passage in Revelation 16, verses 17 to 21, is the prophecy of the destruction of Babylon. It's the last vile judgment, the 21st of the 21 judgments that happened during the tribulation period. And after this judgment happens, Jesus Christ comes back to the earth. Remember, in our study of keys to understanding God's plan for the future, we studied a quick survey of Daniel, Ezekiel, and Revelation. We saw in the book of Daniel the appearance of Antichrist, and I believe the Antichrist is alive today. We also studied the book of Ezekiel, and our attention was focused on the coming temple to be built on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. This last study was on the book of Revelation, and our study today on the rise and fall of Babylon in our world today. We are alive at the time of these three events, the Antichrist, the temple, and Babylon. But remember, the rapture of the church will happen before any of these prophecies will be fulfilled. The rapture is the very next prophecy to be fulfilled, and it could happen at any moment, even today. Next week on the broadcast, we begin a brand new study entitled Alpha and Omega. In this study, we will be looking at the past and the not-too-distant future as we look at the beginning and the end of times in this dramatic study of Bible prophecy. This is one study that you do not want to miss. I'll start in the book of Genesis, where all of Bible prophecy begins, and end with another look into the future from God's prophetic word. Please be sure to join us in our study of Alpha and Omega.
Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and his study on the book of Revelation. This is Jimmy DeYoung Jr., and thank you for joining with us this week.
We have a DVD that we would like to offer. It's called Ready to Rebuild, Revisited. It's the revisiting of our very first video, Ready to Rebuild, 20 years later, looking at what's been done to rebuild the temple in the city of Jerusalem by the Jewish people, the Temple Institute, and all those that are interested in the temple being rebuilt. So if you would like to get that DVD for a gift of any amount, we will gladly send that to you. Just call our ministry at 423-825-6247 and ask for the special offer and that you have a gift that you would like to give Prophecy Today. You know, we need to continue this ministry that my father started, and we will give you, in return for a donation of any amount, we will give you our DVD, Ready to Rebuild, Revisited.
Thank you.
I'm Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA, was shot and killed Wednesday while speaking at Utah Valley University. Greg Yoder, executive director of Keys for Kids Ministry, says Charlie's faith and biblical values informed his political debates.
He had the uncanny ability, kind of like the Apostle Paul, of taking scripture and proving scripture to be absolutely true, but then infusing it into everyday culture and helping young people understand it. And he was, and I think this is why he was targeted, he was actually convincing many of these young people that the ways of Jesus are the right ways of life.
At this cultural moment, Yoder encourages believers to pray and be bold voices for gospel truth in the marketplace of ideas. And on a lighter note, when's the last time God's word changed your life? Charles, a man from southern Nigeria, was never the same after reading a World Missionary Press scripture booklet. WMP's Helen Williams says Charles recently met dozens of her co-workers during a tour of World Missionary Press.
He sat here in my office and just said over and over, "I'm here to thank you. I have wanted all these years to come and thank you. Everybody in our village got your booklet, and it changed my life."
Even though southern Nigeria is overwhelmingly Christian, biblical resources are far and few between. World Missionary Press produces 10 million scripture booklets each month, sending materials to partners in over 200 countries. You can help them put life-changing resources in the hands of people like Charles. We'll connect you at missionnews.org. You're listening to Mission Network News, a service of One Way Ministries. How does radio share the hope of Christ worldwide? This month, Transworld Radio is offering a free book called Making Waves. It's filled with powerful stories of transformed lives and God's fingerprints in action. Get your free copy when you click on the banner ad at missionnetworknews.org. I'm Ruth Kramer.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. And along with my brother Rick, we've been examining current events in the light of God's prophetic word. Rick, I started off the program today reading from 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. It says, "But in your hearts, revere Christ as your Lord. Make your heart holy to the Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect." It's a verse that motivates Christian apologists as they prepare to give answers in defense of their faith. And I think in light of today's program and the news from last week has been superseded by what took place on the campus in Utah with the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And I think one of the things that you and I are impressed by Charlie Kirk and how he lived his life was that he was able to give a defense, to be an apologist, an apologetics for what he believed. He defended the faith. And I think that is something that both you and I have talked about often on this program and even in our conversations with one another.
He certainly was, Jimmy, and listening to him now, and I've listened to him more in the last few days than I ever did before, and I realize how out there he was in proclaiming his faith and living his faith out loud. And it's certainly interested in these days, Jimmy, in this digital age. And, you know, my wife was driving the other day down the road, and she just was flipping through the radio, and she heard a sermon series by our dad, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung, that we didn't even know was being played, but that lives on. And Charlie Kirk's testimony lives on now. And, you know, many of you that are listening right now might say, well, you know, I don't have that same reach that maybe a Charlie Kirk does or a Jimmy DeYoung does. But you know what? If and when you pass and people remember you, they can go to your Facebook. What are they going to see there? Are they going to realize that you lived your life in light of the soon return of Jesus Christ? Are they going to realize that you lived your faith out loud? We can all do it, and we can all have an impact. And that's something that I think that we can certainly take away from this tragedy that happened this week, and we can certainly use that to fuel how we live our lives right now.
Yes. You know, I've used this. I told my daughters that as they were trying to make sense of this, and they were both followers, they were ones that even though they grew up in our family and dad's teaching and my teaching, they seemed to follow after someone who gently responded to the vile evil that people would throw at him. And I would say that it would be a goal that we should all have. And Peter discussed suffering for doing good in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 13 to 14. Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. And I think, you know, with what I see, my prayer is that there will be many people that will raise up to be ready to defend their own faith. It's easy for you and I to do that, Rick. We travel, we preach. I've done it some, you know, a lot of times. Pastors do it. We always let pastors. But I think, you know, as believers, as people that live, I think that we need to be ready to give an account for what we believe. And everyone needs to be able to do that. And I think this should help us to provide a defense or give an answer for one's hope, which is based, you know, on a Greek word, apologian, which carries the idea of defending something as a lawyer would. And I think that's something that should be the goal of all of us, to be able to defend what we believe.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. And, you know, you talk about defending what you believe. Well, you have to know what you believe. You have to study that. So you have to put in the work. You have to put in the hard work at the front. And then, you know, going forward, live your life. You know, you said, you mentioned it, persecution is going to come. We heard that in the book of James, as we talk about, the trials are going to come. Our faith is going to be tested. And of course, we see how that has happened this week for sure. But just be ready, be prepared, do the hard work, get yourself ready so you can be the witness that you need to be and that we are all called to be.
Yes. The command to always be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And that hope is the blessed return of Jesus Christ. And that is something that I think, you know, that as believers, we should be ready to do. I like what you said. You know, we need to do the work. This is not just attending church on Sunday morning. I hope people will see and understand our thoughts. We certainly pray for the Kirk family. I remember it after Ken Timmerman used to talk about the persecution of Christians all around the world. Yes, there are people that are being beheaded for what they believe. And you are going to suffer. In fact, I reminded my daughters of what Paul told Timothy. And all who desire, this is 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12. All who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution, but evil men and impostors will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. But you must continue in the things which you have learned and be assured of it, knowing from whom you have learned them. And I think this is something that as we are living in these days, Rick, it's not going to get better. I try to tell people, look, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. And I think that we are seeing that. I think Ken Timmerman said that. Bill Federer said that. We believe that, and this is what understanding of Bible prophecy does help us to know, that things are going to get worse. The church, the body of Christ, will be taken out of here in that 7-year tribulation period, the time of Jacob's trouble, the day of the Lord, is going to be a time of terrible judgment on people that rejected the love of Jesus Christ. And I think that is something that we need to keep our eyes on. Let's keep our eyes on. I like what you said. Will people, when they look at your social media, will they know that you were a follower and that you look forward to that blessed appearance of Jesus Christ? Were you a lover of people like Jesus was a lover of people? Rick, thanks for doing such a great job on the program today.
Jimmy, this is something that we feel so strongly about, and we feel strongly about preparing you for what is going to lie ahead in our future.
Yes, and with everything that we have seen today, we can't help but say that the rapture of the church cannot be far away. It could even be in the next moment. Let's keep looking up until.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Jay Johnson inviting you to join us again next week for more of Prophecy Today.